Hey everyone, hope you enjoy this interview with Marco Walsh. Just wanted to remind everyone, read the show notes because there is a contest and you can win a free copy of The Fish Companion or a really awesome poster. All right, on to the show.
Hey everyone, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 92. We're really excited to have a conversation with Marco Walsh, who's the board president of the Mockingbird Foundation and one of the sort of an original leading minds behind fish.net and also co-editor of the most recent Fish Companion, which I hope everyone has. We talked about it a lot. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And Marco, thanks so much for taking the time and joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you. It's good to be here.
As I said, it was episode 92. That's ironic because we were just talking about 1992, and we'll go back to that. So we will we'll make our way to 1992 Fish eventually. But Marco, we had gone back and forth and involved a lot of people in the conversation, Charlie and Ellis and others. And appreciate you sort of representing the group and chatting with us about a lot of stuff. I guess the first thing we want to do is just kind of start from the beginning and let people know, you know, where did the idea for fish.net come from?
Sure. Well, that's, you know, I think it's a pretty exciting history and interesting story. You know, when we talk about the fishnet, we're really talking about two things. We have the website, www.fish.net. which is an information and community site that the Mockingbird Foundation sponsors. But the fishnet also historically is, I think, refers to the broader online community that established itself and grew around fish fans. So from the beginning, this band attracted a certain kind of geeky connected fan. You know, we know this, we still are obsessive, yeah. We're engaged, and on top of technology. So even in the late 80s, you know, the band gave us an experience that was worth obsessing over. They mixed up their set lists. Their shows were growing and as they were spreading across the country. They let us tape and tape trades, and trade tapes. And, you know, even more so, the music was interesting and funny and confusing. They had these bizarre songs with strange names, and you know, there's this whole Gamehenge thing. There was this lore. You'd see fish, and it's like, what did I just see? What's going on here? You know, I think it really invited analysis and more exploration. So, you know, a lot of us, the early fans, I'm not the earliest, I first saw them in 92, but, you know, the early fans were a lot of college students, a lot were also active already on the early internet. So you had two things come together perfectly. We had a band that was worth talking about, fans who had information to discover and share, and then there was access to technology that let us do it better. So the Fishnet, a pioneering online community, was born. What I'd call the greater fishnet began in late 1989 when the first email discussion list was started.
Wow.
Started with 13 people emailing to each other on a list, sharing set lists and tour info and stuff, and grew pretty quickly. Within a number of months, there were 200-300 users on there using this mailing list, trading tapes, just helping each other get more into fish. So this is where the fans started collectively documenting the experience. Late 1990 was the first set list file, tried to pull that together. And then in fall of 1990, the band mentioned Fishnet in their newsletter, which sent a lot more people our way. So from the beginning, there was really, I'd say, a communal ethic to the Fishnet. You know, everyone was there. They were, we were obviously, you know, everyone was really stoked about this new band. They were all there to share and get more out of their experience. Everyone was encouraged to take the information that was there, share it, use it, add to it. And that was a big deal, submitting your set lists and your experiences. But don't sell the information. You know, it belonged to the community, not any individual. We also had that, you know, idea around tapes. It was like, Fish lets us tape, you know, trade the tapes freely, don't sell them. So kind of from the very beginning, the things like the set list file actually had a copyright notice on them that said copyrighted. Ellis, who's our executive director, put that on there on behalf of the community.
Nice.
So, you know, with the traveling fan base there, You're what am I going to sell in the lot? It's kind of an easy idea. Oh, I'll sell some tapes. I'll print out the set lists and sell them. And kind of the community jumped on that. No, you shouldn't do that. So I think people learned pretty quickly that, no, this is something to share freely. And I think this, we try to continue with this ethic today, you know, with the Fishnet website, and you still see it with this huge fan base. We on Fishnet, we try to give the core information about the band and their shows away for free, available to everyone. And yeah, people still try to follow that. So Fishnet, getting back to the evolution of the Fishnet, during those early years, a lot of the cool stuff we had to do with documenting and understanding fish and sharing this info with each other. So websites were early, but we used other early internet technology to create repositories of shared files. We used to go to things like the gopher.fishnet or an FTP site at ftp.fishnet, where you go in there and you'd find folders full of files. That's where you could download the setlist file. There were lyrics files. There were show reviews. There were really cool band interviews. Actually, people like Brian Feller and Shelley Culbertson would sit down with the band and do these really in-depth interviews that they would then write up and you know, put on the Fishnet
and share through share through this specific, you know, that right. This specific group had access to, which is just really interesting.
They were files. People would email them around, or they'd, you know, sit on the FTP site. Shelley actually was a really active early Fishnetter, and she ended up moving over to the band's management. I think she also, through that interview, gave the band the live tapes that ended up on the CDs of Junta.
Oh, nice.
So there was always early on a good relationship between Fishnet and the band through Shelley. So early 1992, mailing list it got pretty big and unruly, and the Fishnet made the great leap over to Usenet. Some of you guys might remember Usenet, a big network of what we call message boards today. They were shared across the internet. You had your mainstream groups. These were the rec groups, the rec hierarchy. Those are like, you know, main channels that were carried by everybody. You could find that anywhere. And then there were alt groups that were more alternative that, you know, it covered everything. So, but were much harder to access. So at the time, there were really only four rock bands, rock type groups that had their own rec group. It was the Dead, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and Kate Bush. And everything else, you know, the internet, the old internet geeks would go over to the alts or put it in some broader group. Fish fans were organized. We pulled the levers and in 1992 got the people together that got the support and created Rec Music Fish or RMP, which is where things really took off. That was a centralized place where people would get together, talk about fish.
Was there anything else happening within the scene at that time in terms of this sort of information? Was this pre sort of Andy Gadeel and that sort of stuff, or is this around the same time? I'm just curious about the how the broader community were developing.
Yeah, this is still, this is before Andy had his site going. I want to say, you know, I think most of what was going on was through RMP, was through the internet. Mm-hmm. There was also, I wasn't on it, but I think there was a parallel but smaller community growing on AOL. That was, you know, back in 92, you were either on the internet. We were mainly students, so that's where we had our access. Or if you were at home, you're on, you know, CompuServe or AOL. So there was definitely an AOL group going on as well. So yeah, it built, you know, tens of thousands of users. One thing that's kind of cool, another kind of pioneering thing that we did, 1993. All the Fishnet resources were on a guy's computer who was at Brown University. He was graduating, and we were going to lose the computer and the free internet access. So the community raised money. We basically crowdsourced buying a server and buying the bandwidth, buying a home to maintain the Fishnet, maintain the online community. That grew into NetSpace. That was actually became a nonprofit that hosted a lot of kind of alternate communities. But that was a pretty cool thing that this, you know, virtual community, it's no individual, but we pulled together to preserve our existence. So that was, another cool thing that happened. So, around those years, www.fishnet, as websites spread, there was one built at fish.net. More fans jumped in with their own things. You mentioned Andy's site, Andy Gadiel's fish page. I think Andy started around 95 when lots of people were jumping on board.
Yeah.
And, great guy, great site. He was he wanted to combine his passions for fish and technology and built a website that attracted a lot of people, a lot of views. Andy's a friend of mine, but I've got to laugh because there was a, I mean, we're all obsessive, and there was some competition there with Gadiel's page over silly things when you think about it now, like attribution, like who wrote down the set list. But I laugh because, I considered Andy's page to be like the first noobs, There were these newcomers that showed up. But totally. Of course, they're like the oldest of the old school now.
Well, that's how I entered into the online fish world. As you describe, I saw my first show in 95 and found Andy's page first before I knew about the internet in general. It was like this place that I heard from someone who was in a similar situation. So I think you're absolutely right that that's how a lot of people came through that conduit and then sort of, discovered everything else later, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was Andy did a great page. There were lots of people there. In hindsight, the rivalry was pretty silly. But it also, it helps light a fire and you get stuff done.
Yeah, and it probably it adds to innovation, right? You got competition and healthy competition, but people are trying to think how they can continue to add value for fans, and that's an awesome impetus.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also, something that's pretty cool is that it has always remained centered around the band. I mean, even as we're all building our own things, it's always about helping fans better understand and love fish. It remains about fish and not our personal endeavors.
Yeah.
So kind of a rapid fast forward, where are we? We're in the mid-90s. We've got RMP is where a lot of the people are participating, Rec Music Fish. We've got Fishnet website, other websites like Andy's. Definitely a very engaged online community. It was getting really big. There were a lot of people. It's hard to maintain a collective ethic when there are thousands and thousands of people there. And we might all remember you were seeing a lot more of resources that were shared freely, getting sold, people printing out set list books and selling them on lot. CDs, when CDRs came, that was, everything was for sale. For a while, so many new fans would go buy live CDs on eBay. It was kind of silly. And we'd try to, no, you can get this for free. You can have it. So crazy one of the things that we... Yeah, it's it's really interesting as technology and all this evolves and as we learn to use it. So late 90s, I want to say about 90, late 97, a lot of us who were working on the set lists and the like saw the need to organize it a bit. So they came together and started the Mockingbird Foundation. The idea developed that we would both, it would be an organization, a nonprofit, that would create and protect intellectual property about the band. So it would spearhead, organizing and gathering all this and writing all this information that we do. And also, if there was money to be made, we would make it and give it all to charity. The cause being youth music education, something that was always under fire. Music education is so underfunded.
Yeah.
And, the hope was maybe if we do things right, this will help inspire the next fish. That Trey may be out there, and if he doesn't get drums in front of him. He might never become the musician. She might never become the musician that's going to get the next generation.
Yep.
So, Mockingbird Foundation kind of took what was founded, incorporated, registered as a charity. We saw the opportunity to create a book. Books were going to be created, so we launched The Fish Companion was our book that built on this core information, and we tried to create the definitive book about fish. Published that through a mainstream publisher. It came out in 2000, and had some friendly competition with some other great folks that were doing books as well.
Yeah.
which was awesome. You know, all about love for the band. We were able to raise and start giving away money. Good stuff. We'll talk a little more about that. So yeah. Rushing through, let's get to where we are now with the Fishnet. Because around 2004, the band had broken up. Fishnet website itself had kind of languished. It was rudderless. You know, no one really ran it. It was which volunteer rebuilt it last.
Mm-hmm.
So 2005, Mockingbird Foundation, we formally took over sponsorship and management of it. This will be one of our projects. Under the leadership and the talented coding of Adam Scheinberg, he built a new website from the ground up. We moved to the core fish information, the set list, song histories, et cetera, into a centralized database. So that it would be really manageable. It was in files, text files before that. We rented the servers. We put it all online and relaunched Fishnet website. In the years since then, it's grown and evolved. We launched APIs, interfaces to the database under the hood that let other websites access and use the data. So as a result, now there are dozens of sites that use fish set lists that pull it straight from fish.net. You see a story on Jambase, on Fantasy Tour set lists, Fish OD, the sites that let you stream audience recordings. Pretty much any site that needs fish set lists, they pull them from Fishnet. We added forums, and a large community of fans now make Fishnet their home online to chat and discuss. There are plenty of other places, but ours is one of them. And I'd say we've got about 50,000 registered users now who come to the site to get set lists, and they can add their reviews to songs, shows, anything else on the site.
Awesome.
Do blogs, news stories, getting tens of thousands of views. And even, during showtime, during a busy show, the site literally gets millions of hits. We try to keep it up, and it challenges our technology. But everyone's coming to Fishnet to get the up to the second update of the show. You even see, I see lots of people inside shows on their phones pulling up Fishnet. Like, when was that last played?
Yeah.
And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely cool.
So that's a kind of a long history, but that's where we are today. We really have, the fish.net website and the Mockingbird Foundation. We have our roots going all the way back to the first fish fan mailing list in 1989. And we look to keep that going, the fish online community.
That's awesome. That was a great, great history. And obviously, we all appreciate what you guys have done and all the time that's been put in. It's pretty incredible. And like you said, others have, jumped in since, but it's, I think you guys have inspired a lot of people and a lot of people to think about what they can contribute. And we talked about Mockingbird a bit, and, we've been talking with, I think all of our listeners have heard Tom Marshall's has launched a podcast, Under the Scales. And, he wants to sort of dive in more deeply on the Mockingbird side, which will come out in the next, 3 to 4 months probably. But what else would you add, Marco, on the Mockingbird side? Obviously, you guys have done a ton of good and given away a ton of money and, been able to kind of use this to further the musical interest and also just, knowledge and history of the band, including the most recent Fish Companion. But what else would you say about Mockingbird at this point?
Sure. Well, Mockingbird Foundation, we are a 501c3 charity. We're a nonprofit organization of fish fans. We are a fan-run group. We're all volunteer, so we have no paid staff. None of the volunteers take a salary or get paid for anything. We have very minimal expenses. Pretty much everything that we bring in with just very small expenses goes out to fund grants in the area of youth music education. We really try to represent and draw forward the best characteristics of the fish fan community, which, while we can be kind of strange and obsessive, I think fundamentally it's a really good community of kind people wanting to do good. And so, through that, Mockingbird Foundation, we have a dual charter. On one side, we want to create and maintain that knowledge, that information about the band. And then on the other side, we're raising money from the fish fan community to fund grants in youth music education. So how do we do that? We've, like I said, in 1999, we announced we were publishing a book. And in 2000, the first Fish Companion came out, published by a mainstream publisher. They did a second edition, I think, in 2004. And then this year, we published the third an awesome edition of the book, a 900-page full-color hardbound Fish Companion that we're really proud of, that's actually published by us, by the Mockingbird Foundation.
That's pretty awesome. It's a beautiful, and I mean, I'm not just saying that because we're talking. It's a beautiful book. There's so much info in there, and I think in this age of being able to have information on demand about everything, it's nice to go back and flip through a beautiful tactile sort of product. And you guys publishing it yourselves is obviously. I thought about it when I was flipping through that just the editing and the time that it takes to put the content together, edit it, and not to mention the layout, design, photography. I mean, it must have been a huge undertaking. Was that a couple of years in the making, the most recent one?
Books are hard. It took us a lot longer than we expected. A number of years ago, you can look back when we announced what we were doing. We tried to publish a third edition with our publisher. They were supposed to offer a lot of help. Books are hard, and it didn't come together. So in the end, we left, parted as friends, and they said, you guys should really self-publish this. They gave all the rights to the book, back to the Mockingbird Foundation. So nice. We had this thing, and it's like, what are we going to do with it? Really wanted to create a book that truly honors the band and is a beautiful thing for the fans. It's, we saw a great opportunity there. So yeah, it took us a number of years, and we had some false starts with all volunteers to get the right book done. I think we did deliver to the vision by self-publishing. We were able to invest a lot more in the actual quality of the book.
Yeah.
And people who haven't seen it, when it's almost, 800, 900 pages. It's a hardbound book. We've got hundreds of pages of huge, the best photography that's ever been published about the band. We commissioned some amazing artists who illustrated each era of the band, folks like David Welker and AJ Masthay. And where if it had been a mainstream book, it would have been 400 pages, black and white. They would have spent about, 50 cents printing it in Asia, because that's what's commercially viable. But we were able to really try to make something beautiful. We created an art book. These babies cost a lot to print.
Yeah.
But it's worth it. We wanted to make, nobody needs a fish book, but hopefully everyone wants one. And in the team, I've got to say, my co-editor, Philip Zerbo, was the guy who really, at the end of the game, pulled it all together and created the book that you see today, the right book. It was a challenge to, how do we condense 33 years of fish into a single volume?
Yeah.
Did some amazing stuff there. So that's, yeah, product we're really proud of, a project that I think really represents on the information side what Mockingbird Foundation is about. Other projects we've done, though, to raise funds, we've got other things. We did a tribute album, Sharon the Groove, Sharon in the Groove. That one was really well received. I love that album. We've done benefit concerts, events, done a series of posters of art prints that are have some of those have been really awesome. Those earn well to fund our grants. And, you know, all in all, we've been able to raise so far over $1 million. We've given it away, raise and give away $1 million, more than 300 grants to great schools and nonprofits in all 50 states. And, you know, we just plan to raise and give away a whole lot more.
Nice.
So that's the Mockingbird Foundation. You are the Mockingbird Foundation. We really want to represent all fish fans doing good.
That's awesome. And yeah, I mean, it's a good time of year to be talking about this, because if you have a family member or friend who's a diehard fan who doesn't have it yet, it's a perfect time. It's an awesome, it is a great product. So thank you guys for all the time you've put into it.
Come get it at fishcompanion.com.
Fishcompanion.com.
If you're thinking about getting it, I'd say jump on it now. We've got some left now. I can't promise we'll be able to say that too much longer. It's also available on Amazon, but really the best, or from Fish Dry Goods, but the best deal is to get it from fishcompanion.com.
Cool.
Or go to Nectar's. They sell it at Nectar's. So if you want to get it with some gravy fries.
Nice.
Nectar's in Burlington.
Awesome. We'll link to the to that URL you mentioned in the show notes, fishcompanion.com. And Marco, let's talk a little bit about your as in, you know, the .NET Mockingbird community, your sort of relationship interaction with the band over the years. And I know there's been some great moments that you all have inspired, and I know that they've done some shout outs. I would love to hear your perspective of, even from the, you know, early days, how that relationship evolved and how it's evolved since.
Sure. So, let's see, the band and the management, I want to say they're very appreciative and supportive of what we do. We have a great relationship with them, but the Mockingbird Foundation is definitely an independent, entirely fan-run, autonomous group. I don't think Fish has ever asked us or told us to change anything, to do something differently. But we do try to operate from a position of mutual respect. So like I said, you know, back at the beginning, Fish said, here's the mailing list. If you want to connect with other fans, here's how you do it. And definitely drove fellow fans our way. But the Fishnet stuff, the gathering of the information, we've certainly done as fans on our own. Let's see, on the content side, organization, they are very supportive. Soon after we published the first book, Mike actually sent us back an annotated copy. He tore it up. He wrote up all his comments and corrections, and he had a lot to say. We work with Kevin Shapiro, who you know is the band's archivist.
Yep.
He is part of our setlist team. So he's been very supportive and active in helping us with setlists and other history. If we uncover new information, we send it to him. He confirms it from the band's database. As they discover new shows, he feeds them to us. So he's definitely part of the greater team, and we have a good relationship there, a good partner there.
Hey, have you, the band also, Marco, let me just ask you, did you have Mike's notes of the book ever been released anywhere or talked about publicly? I don't remember seeing them.
I don't think so. We didn't like put a photo of the book out. It's definitely, you know, we've definitely shared that Mike did that for us.
Hold on to that a big fundraiser, you know?
Yeah, that would be awesome. when the book first came out, I think Trey called Ellis to thank him. I know they answered the phone. It's like, this is Trey. And it's like, yeah, right. Sure it is.
Right.
Quit messing around.
Call today. Yeah.
But we have, you know, the fish does their own thing under their own priorities to their own rules. So we don't, you know, have a lot of FaceTime. We are fans on the outside, but they definitely know what we're doing and appreciate it and get to see what's going on. That said, other important things that we have had good relationship with the band financially. We do raise most of our funds ourselves, but the band's also been very supportive of our giving. When Fish, some people might remember when Fish launched the Live Fish program, Trey said, "We're going to give all the money to Mockingbird."
Yep.
And he actually did. I mean, it was true. We didn't ask for that. But, you know, Trey, for a couple of years there, there were some very generous checks coming from the Live Fish program. Awesome. That let us fund a lot of stuff. The band then, you know, broke up, went on hiatus. So they cut back a little bit on their giving, but they're still a generous partner, and we get checks there that we're able to pass on. A lot of... let's see what else. We're also doing a lot more partnering lately with the Water Wheel Foundation. That's the band's own charitable nonprofit group. They get, a dollar off of every fish ticket. They've recently been matching some of our grants. So one thing that we've been able to do on some of the regular grants we give out, we pick a few of them. And an amazing program where we think it'll help, they may ask for $5,000, and we send them 10, and 5 comes from us, and 5 comes from Fish.
Wow.
And it's like, you know, like a miracle grant there. You get double. That's right. Let some programs do some great stuff. Water Wheel's done some benefits for us. We're doing a pre-show reception together on December 30th at Madison Square Garden.
Nice.
That's going to benefit Mockingbird, so we can fund more grants next year. We've also we help give away the funds from the Christy Anastasio Manning Fund. Christy was Trey's sister, mm-hmm. who sadly passed of cancer a number of years ago. There were some funds raised in her memory, and the band asked us, because Mockingbird does a good job of vetting recipients, of finding good places to give the money. We've actually been awarding grants to both help give away those funds, keep Christie's memory fresh, and just help out there. So I know... we're honored to be able to do that, and I think that's pretty meaningful to the Anastasios.
That's really cool.
So other influence towards the band, there have been some fun things over the years. You know, fans always try to influence stuff. You know, Red Rocks 96, I remember that. People on Rec Music Fish put together a sheet of, you know, audience responses to things. It was, you know, during the quiet part of Divided Sky, everyone sit down, blow the band's mind by doing something collectively. The one thing that stuck out of that is the Hood chant in Harry Hood. That was the first time when they said Harry and everyone said Hood. And that was a planned thing that stuck, for better or for worse.
Yeah, that was printed on handouts, right?
Yeah. That's so that, awesome. You know, that's individuals in the Fishnet, you know, used the network to spread that around. And so, you know, Fish does their own things, but sometimes there can be things that get into the show. I want to say most recently, one of our volunteers, Brian Feller, great guy who's helped us on a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. He was backstage before the Gorge and got a little FaceTime with Trey and actually sat down and showed him the book, the new book. Trey was really stoked about it. You may have seen a photo of the book. That was something that Brian did. And in talking to Trey, somehow it came up, is there anything you'd like to hear? And Brian said, cross-eyed and painless. And so they opened the second set with that. And that really drove the show there. That was an amazing show. And you know, so that was kind of a one-off, but I will say that that was a great Mockingbird volunteer who did get a little opportunity to bend the band's ear.
That's awesome. It
had a good effect. So yeah, the band's great. We're definitely a fan organization, but we appreciate the support and mutual respect.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much to talk about, but we have limited amounts of time, so I'll jump around. But
sure.
Do you still feel competitive in the way that you did in the early 90s with the proliferation of fan sort of, you know, fan-focused content, whether it's podcasts like this or blogs or websites? You mentioned Fantasy Tour, which came along a long time ago, but do you guys still kind of what's the current group's attitude toward everything else that's coming out? Is it still just we're all in this together? Are you trying to kind of identify new value and differentiate and all that?
I can just speak for me. I think we've outgrown, you know, some of the more petty competitive mm-hmm. stuff. We can't do everything. The podcast, the new stuff is great. I think anyone who's doing something to help grow the Phish experience for mutual fans, that's a good thing. We have our role, which is to which is what we're doing. We're documenting the Phish experience. We've got every Phish show and every side project we can find documented in as much detail as possible. And we try to, so we've got, that's like 3,000 plus shows that you can find the information and tons of one-off side projects. We want to, that's available to everyone. So hopefully as you're doing your podcast, you know, you come to Fishnet or link to it through the API and
yep.
you've got that information there. So I don't see anyone else as competition. That we're, you know, we're not doing this to make a profit for us. We want to raise money to give it away.
Yeah.
So I'd say sometimes there's confusion. A lot of people think we're Water Wheel Foundation.
Yep.
You know, there's always a little of that. So we want to push to, you know, to keep our name and message clear. To, you know, keep the website up and running so that it's available and hopefully, a happy growing place. We've all grown up a bit and we've had some success with what we're doing. I think we're all comfortable with the mission now and a little more mature and less angsty, and so we're not trying to pick a lot of fights out there.
Yeah, we all are. We've witnessed, I guess, encapsulation of Phish jams and improv and the ranking and all that stuff, and we often obviously reference Phish.net, especially when it comes to specific shows or songs or, you know, histories and the great stuff that you guys have. And I poke fun at the ranking stuff. This is a must hear versus this is a you should hear if you have extra time. So I think that's
sure.
that's always fun to go, but we always have to check to get the info. Is that sort of obsession with, you know, the jams and the songs, how much is supply versus demand, I guess?
Yeah, well, so we're all fans, and some of this stuff, fans have their different ways of enjoying the shows and the experience. You know, you've got tapers, you've got stats people, you've got some people, you've got timers, so a good group of people have come together around Phish.net, and some of the teams that that create the content that's on the site. We do have a set list team, a jam chart team. We've got the team of writers that do the blogs and the song histories. We've kind of identified what's the core information that we want to have there and available. And then everything's open to be commented on, reviewed, corrected. So we're always getting a lot of input from the users of the site. They certainly let us know when they have a different opinion of something that's subjective. Teases are something that, people will fight forever over right. whether something's a tease or not. We've got we've got some teases from the 90s that we're still fighting over. It's become a running joke, but ultimately the suggestion, it comes into a team of people who've been doing this for a while. They kick it around. They'll sometimes, fight and scream over it. And ultimately someone decides and a decision's made and it goes up on the site. And then we'll get, 50 complaints from people saying, "You're freaking deaf. You're wrong." And we'll look at each of those and maybe reconsider it. And, the subjective is always, people have different opinions, but we do our best with that. As to what information we provide, I think that's fan-driven. We've tried to come up with the set of info that people will find valuable there. There are new and different ways of diving into the experience that we put up on the site. There are also others out there who may have their own ideas, and they can access the data. So, I don't think we do a lot of infographics on our site, but there are definitely people out there that are into that are doing graphical interpretations of fish and yep. The fish shows, and they pull our data, and that adds to the big picture. So hopefully we're providing consistent, accurate, complete information for people to draw from and build on, and then a platform for everyone to, leave their reviews and their opinions nice. As well.
Awesome. Well, just a couple more questions, Marco. We'll let you get back to your afternoon. But I guess first, what do you think the influence of particularly fish.net has been on other jam band scenes or other jam bands? I mean, do you guys see a lot of the younger bands, having these sort of more online engagement? Do you feel like you guys have played a pretty big part in that?
That's a good question. I personally haven't seen a lot of other jam bands with this level of information. Mm-hmm. I mean, one I'm familiar with, Humphreys McGee, they have a badass site. That site was built by Adam, who's our coder and one of our directors.
Nice.
So awesome. If anything, there's definitely, it's the same people. I think a lot of things that he did first here, he was able to perfect there at Humphreys McGee. Humphreys has a really great relationship with their fans, and they do some really cool, innovative stuff.
That's cool.
Other jam bands that I've followed, I've not seen it come together. I think people try to track set lists. I may be totally wrong. I don't know if some of these new bands, everyone talks about Twiddle. Do they have a good set list site?
I don't know. I know that they, people are talking about their music, but that's a good point. And well, it takes a community like we've been talking about, right? It's not just, one guy can't do it all.
It's tough. Yeah. It you really need to get that critical mass of people creating, but you also, it often does take the one guy too or a few guys to sit down and, do the hard work. Someone's got to build the website, build the framework, and then the information can be crowdsourced. I've seen Soundtribe Sector 9, STS-9. They're a band that's out of Santa Cruz and have long done some amazing stuff. I remember when I was really into them and filming them around 2001 or so. Set lists, there was one guy who was great, who was doing all the taping. He was maintaining a set list website, but, it was hard to pull in the set lists from everyone. I don't know. It was hard to get the critical mass there.
Yeah.
So I think we've maybe set a model for what can be done. And hopefully other communities will follow that. We have to give the obvious nod as well to the Grateful Dead and how fans documented that. I mean, that's where keeping set lists came from. one of the places, I think, for a lot of us. There are other, there are other set list sites. I don't know that they draw from us, but hopefully, again, we can continue to set a good model for others to follow.
Nice.
And I do think the charity aspect, the fact that we are doing this not for personal gain, mm-hmm. but for the benefit of the community, and we're able to give back and help kids, that gives people a little more to rally around, whereas someone trying to build a private website just based off of their passion, it may be a little trickier to get the energy around that. I also think, I don't know how many bands maintain their own sites that are able to do it as effectively. I mean, Umphrey's is an official site. They do great.
That's fair.
I'd say, Phish for a while tried to put their own set lists up, and that project didn't complete. For a while they were on fish.com. So they do a great job of tweeting out shows as they happen. Yeah. I mean, Live Fish is pioneering. They certainly invented Couch Tour as we know it today and do a lot there. But the archiving part has really been done by the fans.
Right on. Yeah,
and it's one model that works great.
Yeah, and I think you guys have inspired a lot of content and a lot of, I think, other bands too, probably more than you guys know. We've talked a lot about, and we're going to leave people some music. I just want to ask one more question. You've talked about, this being a creation for fans and by fans, and I am interested in the kind of perception that the Phish.net community particularly is like a little bit clicky and is a little bit exclusive. I know you guys are all kind of tight knit, but it can be kind of hard to break into it in terms of, the show reviews and the stuff that you guys publish. And I think in the last 2 years or so, what I've seen is that you guys are publishing a lot more people who aren't just, long-term members of the Phish.net community or part of the organization in whatever iteration they are. And so I'm just curious if that's been a conscious effort to sort of get outside and reach new audiences and get outside of the original group, or is that more just people maturing and having less time and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that's a good critique. We certainly don't want to be a clicky group of old farts. It is a challenge to create the structure that invites new people in. So it's something we're working on. I would definitely, yeah. in my perfect world, want to see an organization where there's a really obvious space for people to come in to offer that help. To kind of learn what are the standards of how we do things and, join that set list team or that review team. We are trying to bring more new voices in. And you'll see more of that. People who have come up either through the forums or through you people who we've, found are good writers with things to contribute.
Nice.
It's just a matter of of getting them slotted in there, and with an all-volunteer group, you get what gets volunteered.
Yeah.
So I think there's certainly an intent. We want to represent and give a voice to all Phish fans. There's still some work to go in, building the platform and building the process around it. There is room for a lot more voices. We've at least, through user reviews, through giving the spot for people to comment on everything, hopefully people can use that platform there. And I think you'll see more blogs, more different voices who are still hopefully a compelling read up there on the platform. We certainly don't want to shut people out, but I don't know that we're equipped to open the door wide and filter through everything that comes in.
Nice. I think that's
if
cool.
that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But totally yeah, we have some new blood. There's definitely a generational thing, and a lot of us are you know 1.0 farts. We came from the old rec music fish, and are still doing this because it's what we love to do.
Yeah.
And we want more of the kids with us too. it's just a matter of getting them in there as well.
Right. Well, no, I think you guys have done a great job of doing that. Like over the past several tours, I think that's awesome. And it is hard. Like you said, the capacity piece is an interesting, element that I'm sure is always present for you all. As with a lot of us who are doing these, you know, sort of volunteer things, but we don't get as much inbound stuff as you guys do, obviously. So, that's a tough balance, but I mean, you guys are also, you have an approach and you have a history of doing things in a way that I think is really, you know, satisfying for fans. So, you know, don't lose that, obviously. So I think you guys are doing a great job still and have endured and kind of evolved over these different iterations.
We've gotten some great results out of it. The resource is there. I mean, the site is awesome and continues to be used. I think we created an amazing book that all fans can be proud of and enjoy and send their moms over to fishcompanion.com to buy one now for the yes, holidays.
Absolutely.
And then on top of that, we can only get better at it. And we've certainly learned a lot of lessons. And I think in the, in the coming years, just like, Fish is getting, evolving. They're evolving musically. They're evolving the organization. And we can continue to do that as well. Just, I think we all want to do what we're doing and do it better and smarter.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Marco, for taking all this. We want to leave the audience with some music chosen by you. I want to just set this up a little bit, I guess. Can you just tell us about, we're going to leave you with some choice sort of pieces of a show from 1992, Marco, that is meaningful to you. Can you just talk a little bit about that show and then we'll throw the music on?
Sure. My request is my first show, which is April 17th, 1992 at the Warfield in San Francisco. I had not heard Fish before, but I had heard of Fish and knew it was somewhere that I wanted to be. It was just a mind blower, face melter of a show. You guys can pull up that set list and see just the craziness that went down. Widespread Panic opened. They played a set that, I say for about 20 minutes, Widespread Panic was the greatest new band I'd ever seen. Then I saw Fish.
Nice.
it was just start to finish. The band was so tight then. They were exploring. They were precise. They were funny. They were exploring new things. The show opened with a monster gym, Runaway Gym, went into Foam, or Sparkle, a great stash. Then Fishman, this crazy hairy drummer, comes out with a trombone and plays I Didn't Know. And I mean, he was right. I didn't know that I was that far gone. we got a cavern with syncopated dancing. What? A Reba that was just an epic Reba, one of those soaring early Rebas. We had the precision of Maze. They did Bouncing, and everyone was bouncing around me. And then, the piece I asked you to play was The Landlady. We get a little more Santana feel there that goes into Bowie with the first with the debut of Catapult woven in and out of the Fire Jam there at the end of the Bowie.
Yes.
This is the famous Bowie, Catapult, Bowie, Catapult, Bowie. A lot of fans will remember this and have heard this because it was the common filler on everyone's Stowe Vermont tape, the tape with Santana. So I think that's the piece you guys are going to play. One other powerful vision that stands out to me, I don't know if you'll have time to play it, but the next set opening, Brother, was still one of the more bizarre things I've seen that really left me confused and needing to know more about this band. The curtain opened and there was a bathtub on the stage. It looked like it had been ripped out of the wall. It had, you know, the bricks on the side, and it had a shower there, and there's some dude sitting in it. And wow. As the band's singing, "Whoa, somebody's definitely jumping in the tub with your brother," all these crazy people were dancing across the front of the stage and getting into this bathtub. And it had turned out it had Mike's nice. Brother in it. And so that was just, I mean, I'm still baffled by the weirdness of that, of this crazy band starting a set with a bathtub on stage and weirdos dancing across the front and getting in the tub. You know, they're still a great fun band. They still have this crazy, silly stuff to pull out.
We'll definitely play that.
1792, great soundboard, my first show, and that's the one that hooked me, and I'm still here.
That's awesome, Marco. Well, we appreciate you, you know, all your contributions to Mockingbird Foundation and Phish.net, and on this 92 show, we'll definitely include the brother, because with that visual, you know, we gotta come through with
awesome.
The music. But we really appreciate you taking the time, and thanks for you know, your support and your contributions and all that. And hopefully we can continue to chat.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, and everybody, read the book.
Read the book, and just in time for the holidays, we'll put a link to fishcompanion.com. And you guys have been hearing Marco Walsh, who's the board president of the Mockingbird Foundation. So we really appreciate you taking the time, Marco.
Yeah, thanks. You're welcome.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Keep on rocking.
machine. It performs my daily functions through a tube in my ween. But today that thing malfunctioned. Like a forest fire, it burned a hole in me, I perspired. But there ain't gonna be no wedding, no love affair, no art to which none compares.
We'd like to thank Mike's brother for helping us out with that last tune.